Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, I'm Larry Mueller, and you know just as well as I that gardening can be a real pleasure, but even when we take good care of our plants, nature doesn't always cooperate. Last summer's drought and this month's record rains put a lot of stress on our plants, and when they're stressed, they are less able to fight off pests and diseases. A lot of us are wondering what the long-term effects are going to be. At least I am. I bet you are, too. We have a couple of very knowledgeable people to help us out and have some fun as we talk about the garden. Brian Huddleston, Director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at the UW-Madison Department of Plant Pathology. Dr. Death, welcome.
Thanks, Larry. Thanks for having me.
He's well known as Dr. Death in these parts because he deals a lot with dying plants.
Yes, indeed. And I revel in it sometimes, I must say, unfortunately for some of my clients.
Oh, good. Look at this disease.
That tends to be my reaction, I'm afraid. But people are quite, they put up with me doing that all the time. They're quite nice.
Well, Lisa Johnson's pretty nice, too. She's the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County, been with us many times. Happy to have her back. Lisa, good to see you.
You too, Larry.
I am so pleased to have you both here. And we can talk about a whole host of things in the garden. You can join us with your question. What's going on in your garden? 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show and you can post a question, comment, or even if you got a good garden photo, posted there. I actually posted a photo of my daughter Emily on one of our garden bales, and I mistakenly posted it on my personal page instead of the Facebook page, but I'll try and get it up on the Facebook page so you can see what the bale garden looks like from the Mueller household. Otherwise, again, 1-800-642-1234. Lisa, all this rain that we've been having must be having an impact on our gardens. What are you hearing?
Weeds.
Weeds, yeah.
Weeds and weeds and weeds. The weeds are doing very well. We're starting to see, though, some actual problems with root rots, and I'm sure Brian can attest to that. He's rubbing his hands together in great glee. We're starting to see a little bit of nitrogen deficiency on some things. Nitrogen is one of those things that tends to get leached out of the soil when you have a lot of rain. Yeah. And so we're seeing some problems with that, too.
So a couple things. What are you seeing in your shop, Brian?
It's actually been a little bit slow for us this year. I've been kind of surprised given the rain. We normally see a lot of leaf diseases when we have this sort of weather. Yeah. We have been seeing some anthracnose coming in, which is a common leaf disease on a lot of different types of woody ornamentals. Probably the coolest diseases we've been seeing are what we call the Tephrina diseases. That's the name of a fungus. And if you grow peach trees and get very kind of seersucker sort of leaves with a lot of buckling, and oftentimes the leaves will have kind of a bright fuchsia color where they kind of bubble up. That's a Tephrina disease called peach leaf curl. But the Tephrina disease I've been seeing quite a bit this year is something called plum pockets. And in this particular case, the fungus infects the fruits and they become spongy and hollow. So they're quite distinctive.
Oh.
And I stopped by a home here in Madison the other day, last week actually, to collect some samples because the homeowner had sent in some photos.
You know, Diane emailed us from Nakusa and says, I have peony plants and some of them have black on the leaves. You mentioned disease. And some of the buds turn black and don't open. Any idea what that might be?
Yeah, it's probably the same thing causing both of those symptoms. There's a fungus called botrytis, and it causes a disease called either botrytis blight or gray mold. And when that particular fungus infects the flowers, it will cause them to turn brown or black and abort. And it can also form these, oftentimes about quarter size, fairly discreet black spots on the leaves.
Okay.
And it's not what I consider a fatal disease or something that's really, really serious. I typically tell folks to clean up the debris in the fall that's been infected and try to get that out of the garden, out of your yard. You could certainly compost that material if you hot compost, get the temperature high enough. But it's something we tend to see on peonies year after year after year. This year it's been a little worse on the flowers because it has been so wet.
Facebook question from Akita, and then we'll take some calls. But Akita has a yellow rose bush, Lisa, and this year it produced 3 colors, of roses, yellow, white, and red. What's your explanation?
That's really bizarre, but a lot of our rose bushes are grafted, and I am thinking that probably what's happening is that some of the stems that you're seeing are coming from below the graft. So the grafted plant was the yellow rose, and the other colors may be coming from a rootstock that was grafted underneath. Often we do see red. And sometimes, unfortunately, if it's white, they used to use multiflora rose, which is a invasive species, as a rootstock on older roses. I'm not so sure that they use that anymore, but it does have white flowers. And often I see red, too. Mm-hmm. So not quite sure exactly that that's what's going on, but that would be my first guess at it.
Yeah, makes sense to me. Ed in Greendale, it's your turn. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Good morning. I have a Rose of Sharon that I transplanted last year. It bloomed lovely late in the season, but now this season it hasn't come back. It hasn't come out of dormancy. Is this too late for it, or should I still be working on it?
That's pretty late.
Pretty late.
I'm sorry to say. I know they are very late in coming back. Do you see anything coming at the base at all?
I don't.
No.
The stems are still red and supple. I've pruned it a little bit, and there's green inside the stems that I've pruned.
Okay. Well, you could give it a little longer, but I wouldn't hold out a great deal of hope for it.
No.
Okay.
Sorry.
Second quick question.
Sure.
I have a pear tree that set fruit very nicely, but now just yesterday I noticed that it dropped a number of the small pears. Could that be due to the extra water, the rain, and so forth?
Well, it could, but it could also be simply seasonal fruit drop. Usually most fruit trees will drop up to maybe a third even of the fruits that they produce. And what may have happened last year is that your pear set a lot of buds due to the drought, and producing a lot of trees will produce extra fruits and seeds and so on. So I wouldn't be surprised if it had set extra. And then since the conditions have improved this year, it's dropping those that it doesn't need.
Extras.
Yes,
yeah.
The extras.
There you have it, Ed. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in too at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call with your gardening question. As we speak today with Lisa Johnson and Brian Huddleston, they do a great job of talking about all kinds of garden issues. And Stephanie in Beloit, it's your turn. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think you may have addressed my mildew or mold, whatever it is, white powder on my peonies, just as I was trying to call you. Is there anything I should be doing?
Yeah, that's if you're getting kind of a white powder on the upper and lower surface of the leaves, it's probably powdery mildew. This is a very common group of fungal diseases that we see usually towards midsummer when it starts to get a little bit more humid. They really like high humidity. And on many types of plants, these diseases are fairly cosmetic. It's on delphiniums and peonies, did you say?
Yes.
Yeah, are you seeing any evidence of browning of the leaf tissue, or is it just the white material just kind of over
just
the surface?
Just the white.
Yeah, at that level, I would not become terribly concerned. On certain types of plants like phlox and bee balm or the monardas, we can get a lot of browning of the foliage due to this disease, but on many types of plants, they're very tolerant of this fungal growth. And if you can, cultivate a tolerance of this disease, you're probably going to see it every year to a certain level. And certainly, if you can tolerate it, I think that's the best thing to do. There are some chemical treatments that you could try if you were interested, but quite frankly, I think in this particular situation, I wouldn't bother. It's too late anyway once you see the fungus. Other things you can think about for next year would be to thin a little bit to get better airflow between the plants. That tends to dry things out and reduce the humidity, and that'll help prevent at least some of the disease.
Okay. Now, my other problem was tomato wilt.
Okay.
I have 9 all different plants, and mm-hmm. some are experiencing wilt and some are not. And I I think that's something that's in the soil. It gets into them, and I don't know if there's any other explanation of why they just seem to spontaneously wilt.
Yeah, one question when you describe wilt, sometimes people talk about just the plants growing in an odd pattern as wilt. Do you actually mean where the leaves look really droopy?
Yeah,
and look like
droopy.
They're drying out?
As
well, so far
twisty.
They haven't dried out, but they look like they're on their way.
Yeah, like they haven't been getting enough water. Do you have a walnut tree anywhere near your garden?
Oh, yeah, but it's not affecting the other plants.
That can be very, very specific to individual plants, depending upon where individual roots are growing under the soil. That's one of the common things that we see causing wilt, particularly on tomatoes, which are very, very sensitive. Walnuts produce toxins. And that's what's affecting, most likely affecting your tomatoes. And not all plants are affected by the toxins, but tomatoes are quite sensitive. So what you may want to consider doing is get some large pots, grow them in pots, or try to grow your garden a little bit farther away from the walnut tree. Although, quite frankly, the root system can go out a fair amount from the trunk of the tree.
Way beyond the
way. I thought this place was probably safe because it was quite far away.
Yeah, the root system, what is it, Lisa?
Three to five times
the height of
the
tree away from the trunk. Yeah.
And Brian wrote a wonderful fact sheet on black walnut,
actually,
too.
Ann Joy, who's in my lab.
Oh, I'm sorry,
yeah,
Ann.
She's the one that did the work.
But anyway, it is on Brian's website if you want to check that out.
Yeah,
it has
looked up on which plants were resistant.
Right. It has a list of the ones that are susceptible and which ones are tolerant, so you may want to check that out.
I would take all of that information that we have with a grain of salt, though, because the way we compiled that was to look for references. There's very little direct research on which plants are sensitive, and so we're basically doing it somewhat on anecdotal sort of information, but it at least gives you a start.
It does, and as Judith Sears-Poisson says, containers, the way to go.
with walnuts, yes, oftentimes.
Oh, my goodness, yeah.
And you can space them out, too, and sometimes prevent some of the leaf diseases that we see on tomatoes as well.
Yep.
Okay. Thanks so much, you two.
Yep.
You're quite welcome.
Thanks a lot for calling, Stephanie. Paul in Cumberland. We'll get to you in just a second. I want to remind everybody, Lisa Johnson, one of our guests today, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. Brian Huddleston directs the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller, Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer, on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. What's going on in your garden, or with your trees, or with those shrubs that are around the lawn, or maybe with the lawn itself? Anything going? Things are looking great on our lawn. Everything's growing like crazy. But disease can be there, too, and I know there can be some problems with some plants, so we're really happy to have Lisa Johnson and Brian Huddleston to answer your questions today. And you can reach us at 800-642-1234, just like Paul in Cumberland did. Paul, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. See, I got a question. Last April or May, I just took a couple of small branches off a red oak tree, and all of a sudden last summer that tree, all of a sudden, all the leaves fell out, and that tree died. The one next to it died also, and now this year there's a smaller one that's got brown leaves, and the other two are like 8 to 10-inch really beautiful red oaks, and so I'm wondering what I should do to try to save the oak. And is that oak wilt, or what do you think?
It sounds, by the pattern that you're describing, that it could very well be oak wilt. When you prune, particularly when there are sap beetles active, they can bring in that particular fungus. And unfortunately, those beetles can visit a tree within 10 minutes of you making a cut. I've seen some research to that effect. And they bring in the fungus, drop it off, and then it gets into the water-conducting tissue and blocks that off. And that's why you get the wilting. The trees just can't move water inside like they should. And then it will move from tree to tree through root graft. So all those trees that are, all those red oaks underground, all the roots are fusing together, and it moves through those grafts. And you need to be very aggressive if you've got a grove of oaks like this. I'm going to refer you to a publication where you can read more on this, because there's just a lot of information you need to know that we can't present on the radio today. It's called What Oak Wilt Management, What Are the Options? It's available at our Learning Store site, which is our publications website, and that's Learning Store, all one word, learningstore.uwex.edu. And if you type in the search line, G as in George, 3590, that will get you to that particular publication. Talks about oak wilt, how to manage it in groves. It will involve basically trenching, if you can do that. So basically severing the root grafts between trees and then removing a lot of the trees. And you want to be very aggressive with this because this is a real nasty disease. And particularly on red oaks, it can move very, very quickly, as you've observed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very, very quickly. Good luck. We'll post that bulletin. She posts a bulletin, Judith. Yeah, she'll post that, and the Learning Store site, so you can just click on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. We'll have it up in 30 seconds.
And Judith, if you could also put the Wisconsin arborist, certified arborist website, because he should have a certified arborist out to look at that. There are some treatments that can be done with injected fungicides, but you should get advice from an arborist about whether or not that's
And particularly with red oaks, if they're symptomatic already, I would not recommend the injections quite
rightly. Right, but the ones that aren't symptomatic in order to protect them. It depends on how close they are and so on. But anyway, you probably should have an arborist.
Also quite expensive,
yes,
too.
Yes, it is.
The other thing,
tell me when you can remove those trees, when it has the least amount of potential of transferring that from root to root. Is it the best time in the fall, or is it in the summer, or winter?
Usually I recommend working with oaks in the dormant season, but if you're going to go through, usually the recommendation is if you've got an active pocket of oak wilt, you go in, you do the trenching to break the root grafts, and there's some information in that publication on where you set up the trenches. Once you trench, you basically, the recommendation is to take out, if it's red oaks you're having a problem with, all the red oaks within that perimeter, because even the ones you're not seeing wilt on are probably already infected. And if you want to be aggressive about controlling, getting it under control, you're going to remove all of those. What you do have to be careful of, if you work with the trees at this time of the year, you're going to be bringing equipment in there, and if you whack another tree and make a wound, that can open it up to be infected by insects again. So you've got to be very, very cautious when you do this. What you might want to consider would be to do the root trenching to break the root grafts to prevent the spread, then come back and do the removal during the dormant season. Yep. When, if you do happen to hit a tree and wound it, you're not going to get transmission. If you need to prune any of your oaks at this time of the year for whatever reason, you should have a can of pruning paint or old latex paint, something to cover the wound, and you should do that immediately. Don't wait on that.
Good luck, Paul. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Oh, yeah, that's a bad thing. Yeah.
And with that pruning paint, too, that's one of the very few times that we do recommend using that pruning paint is for oaks and elms with storm damage or other kinds of damage during the growing season. Generally, we don't recommend pruning paint.
Bob in Land O'Lakes, we'll turn to you now. Thanks for calling. Hi.
How you doing?
Good.
I have a compass cherry that's about 4 years old now. I got it from Winter Greenhouse in Winter. Great nursery, by the way, if anybody's up. They specialize in northern plants. But anyway, I had this compass cherry, and every year, it's a healthy tree. It's got a good crown on it, and every year, it's just full of blossoms. And right about now, I start seeing these, and this has happened now, this is the third year. It almost looks like a fire blight or something hitting the not all the ends, but many of the ends get this kind of burned look, and the tips, the growing tips, will just kind of brown. And almost all my fruit, pretty much, you know, even though I have thousands of flowers on the tree, it just doesn't set fruit. And I've had compass cherries in the past and have had good success with them, but this one, getting nothing. I'm just wondering if you know anything.
Hmm. What do you think, Brian? You want to take a crack at that?
Actually, do you not get any fruit set at all? They don't even form, or do they start to form and then they
start to form and then they, you know, like you can see, like right now, they're only about maybe an eighth of an inch long, but you can see them, you know, starting to form. And, you know, at first about, you know, 50% seem to fall off, and then little by little, even the ones that are remaining will fall off.
Do you see any evidence on the fruit surface once they've fallen off of kind of a buff-colored fuzzy material?
I haven't looked at that. I could look at that.
Yeah. One of my thoughts is poor pollination. The other one, though, there is a fungal disease called brown rot. And that will infect the fruits and actually tends to cause them to mummify. But they sound a little bit small for it to be that. Mm. But that fungus will also cause some branch tip dieback. How uniform is the branch tip dieback on the tree?
It's probably 30% of the growing tips, something like that. Okay. And it's pretty dispersed throughout the tree.
Could be a root problem contributing to this as well. There are so many things I can think of that might contribute to the problem that you're seeing. My first thought with the fruit set was pollination issues, that it just isn't pollinating well because the trees will abort the fruit if it's not pollinated.
Yeah. Do you have other fruit trees in the area?
Well, yeah, I don't have. I've been planting apples. I haven't. They're still pretty young, so I haven't really gotten flowering yet. But I got some apples. I raised bees, but I don't have them this year. But I do have a lot of the mason bees around and also bumblebees. So
do you have other cherries, though?
No, I do not.
I know that this compass, if I remember right, is a tart cherry, so it should be self-pollinating. Trying to remember, tart cherry, sweet cherry, one of the two.
I thought this was actually a type of plum that just had a really small plum, and they call it a compass cherry, but I think it's actually a plum.
Okay. Well, then we may have, like Brian was saying, a pollination issue. There are some plums that do need a pollinator tree in order to set fruit. So when you've had success in the past, have you had more than one, or have you had another?
No, I've always only had one, and that one died back in 95 when we had that really deep cold up here.
Okay.
On the branches that are dying back, do you see any evidence of any little globules of sap or oozy sort of material?
No.
Okay.
Or dark sunken spots on the bark?
It just looks like, what you'd think was fire blight. It's like they've been singed, and the tips have bent over, and they brown out for about 3 or 4 inches, into the stem.
But you don't get dieback? I mean, substantial dieback?
You mean like other leaves dropping off?
Yeah, well, or
how far back?
Yeah, how far back does it go?
How many inches back?
I would say maybe 3 to 4 to 5 inches dieback on that branch.
Right. This is one where I think you'd be better off sending us in a sample to see what we're actually dealing with here. If you'd like to do that, you can send a sample into my clinic. I'll give you my website where there's information on how to do that. It's pddc.wisc.edu. And if you're going to do this, I would suggest sending in a set of branches that are showing the dieback. Include some of the live tissue, though. I would send in some of the fruits that you're seeing, both those that are still hanging on the tree that are showing symptoms and those that have fallen off. And I would also like to see a root sample, because some of the dieback could be due to a root rot problem that's just inhibiting water uptake. So I'd like to see whether there might be something of that going on as well. And cherries do have problems with root rots, quite
but
frankly.
But this is a compass cherry plum.
Well, yeah, and even plums, just in
so
general,
it's
prunus.
Prunus, yeah,
prunus in general have problems, and apples, too, tend to have problems with root rots. So I would say that would be important to get me a root sample as well.
So there you go. Thanks very much for calling. And by the way, if you need the address again, go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, and we've got a link to the a link to the Learning Store and to the Arborist site and to the Oak Wilt publication and also to Brian's lab. So there you go. Thank you again for calling. You can join in too at 1-800-642-1234. Facebook question from Carr. Last summer, rumor was that most purple coneflowers were contracting aster yellows via leaf hoppers. Ours looked great until very late in the season, at which time the petals didn't form and there was only a flower center, disfigured at that. When the buds formed this year, they didn't look right, didn't seem to have any petals. The rest of the plant had strong stems and lush leaves, no twisting. Without waiting until bloom, I dug them all up because of the possible transfer to other plants. Did I do the right things? And that's from Mark.
Most likely, yes. We did have a serious problem with aster yellows last year. The organism is leafhopper transmitted. We had a huge influx of leafhoppers very, very early. And not all of them carry this organism, but a high percentage of them were last year, about 10%, as opposed to roughly 1 or 2%, which is more typical. And they do drop off this organism in coneflowers as they feed, and it is a permanent infection.
Okay.
So it's going to be there pretty much all the time. And if the flower beds aren't really looking right, that was probably the right thing to do.
Dan in Watertown. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have another cherry question. This has to do with Lapin cherries or a sweet cherry.
Okay.
And the trees are 8 or 10 years old. They're in an orchard with apples and pears and peaches. And I've got a brown spot or a brown blight fungus, something like that, that encompasses the fruit.
Mm-hmm.
And within 48 hours, 72 hours, it pretty much takes care of 75% of the fruit.
Oh.
And I'd like to know what the critter is, and I'd like to know how to treat it, if I can, for next year.
Yeah, so the fruits are turning brown.
Absolutely. And then they have this fruitish, you know, they have this white fungal thing.
Fuzzy, kind of buff-colored, yeah. It's most likely, and then the fruits kind of mummify, kind of shrink down and look like a mummy. Yeah, that's most likely a disease called brown rot, and it's very common on stone fruits in general. So that includes cherries, peaches, plums, apricots, anything of that sort. And what you need to do, that will also cause a branch dieback, and where the fungus tends to hang out, it could be coming from volunteer prunus species. If you've got a woods nearby, in which case you need to try to find those and get rid of them. But more likely at this point, if you've been having a problem for several years, it is likely hanging out in some of the old fruit that's dropped off the tree and is sitting on the ground or has gotten just very shallowly buried with soil. And you need to find those and get rid of those. Look for any diseased or branches that have died back and prune those out. I would prune down about 4 to 6 inches below where you see the dead tissue on the branch. And then make sure you disinfest your tools between cuts. I would use 70% alcohol for that. Either something like rubbing alcohol or get one of the spray disinfectants and just spray it until it drips and allow it to air dry. If you dip it, about a 30-second drip is fine. And then if it continues to be a problem, also remove any of the fruits that are still hanging on the tree that are mummified. Mm-hmm. And then also if you have problems, continue to have problems, and there are fungicide sprays that you can use for that. If you give me about, I would say about 4 hours, once I'm done with the show here, we should have a fact sheet on this disease available at the disease clinic. I had a student in one of my classes that I helped teach last semester write a fact sheet on this particular disease, and I just need to get it one more step to do and then up on my website, and it will be there. So if you go into my website and then click on the fact sheet tab on my main page, it'll lead you to an alphabetical listing and look for brown rot of stone fruits.
All right, so probably around 4. Around 4.
By the end of the afternoon, if not today, I'll get to it this weekend. But it will be there soon.
Good luck. Thanks very much for calling. Caller Ken was confused, Lisa, when you said that rain will leach nitrogen out of the soil. He thought that lightning adds a lot of nitrogen to the soil.
It's my understanding lightning does add nitrogen to the air. I suppose if it makes a ground strike, there could be some. But nitrogen is one of those elements that is not bound very tightly. And also you have microorganisms using it and plants using it. So that's why we fertilize, is because it gets used up in the soil. And particularly when we have a lot of rain, it tends to leach it past the root zone of the plants.
There we go. And then an email from Shirley, want to know what's attacking my rhubarb. The plant's big and abundant, but the leaves have holes in them. The stalks have many areas of spots, and some of them oozing a gelatinous material. This is making my rhubarb unusable. I would think so. I don't know if I'd want to be eating that gelatinous material oozing out of my rhubarb.
Yeah,
I'm trying to think. Usually when I hear folks talking about ooze, I think about bacterial pathogens, because they oftentimes will infect and then you get a mixture of the bacterium and the sap of the plant oozed on the surface. of whatever's infected. The holes that you're seeing is most likely an insect problem, and I unfortunately can't comment on what that might be. Lisa, you have any idea?
Yeah, I was just thinking, too, rhubarb, usually you don't see a
Although
whole lot.
I do vaguely remember Phil Pelletieri at a recent Wisconsin Hort Update mentioning an insect on rhubarb, but I don't remember what it is off the top of my head.
But it's likely an insect.
Yeah, most likely an insect.
You have.
If the oozy areas are associated with leaf spots, and I'm suspecting that that's probably bacterial. And of course, that's going to be worse when we have a lot of rain like we have had this year. My suggestion would be, again, good fall cleanup. Probably if it's unusable this year, make sure you're cutting back the plant, remove all that material next year, hope for a little bit of drier weather. Oftentimes, in terms of if you want to try to treat with something, as long as if you can find something that's labeled for use on rhubarb that has copper in it, that will oftentimes take care of, or at least reduce the bacterial populations to a reasonable level. I'm basically talking about this off the top of my head, though. It would be really nice if you're really interested in finding out what it is to get a sample in, so we can verify that that really is bacterial that we're talking about.
Here we go.
So I hate to have you treat when we don't know for certain.
David in Freeport, Illinois, it's your turn. Hi, David.
Good morning.
Morning.
Thanks for the opportunity. Earlier this spring, probably the 1st of May, I planted two oak leaf hydrangeas. Now, these plants are probably 2 year old. And since I put them in the ground, some of the leaves have turned brown on the edges and gradually work into the leaf itself. Now, the plant looks healthy. It's in full growth, but am I in trouble?
I'm betting that's probably transplant shock would be.
Well, it certainly could be. You're in Freeport, Illinois. I assume you've been getting as much rain as we have, or what's your weather pattern been?
Well, I would say as an estimate in the last week, we probably had 3.5 to 4 inches. But the location where these plants are growing is a good slope. There's a good path to water to get away. So I'm wondering if it is excess moisture.
It could be, but I think Brian's guess about transplant shock is probably more. Did you have them someplace shady before you put them in where they are now, or what is the...
Well, I planted them the day I received them. They came in through the mail, and I planted them the day I received them. The location they're at now probably gets 7 to 8 hours of sun, the rest shade.
Okay, yeah, that particularly when they come through the mail and, you know, you don't know what sort of situation they've been growing in. They've been in the dark for a few days, and then they're put into a full sun situation and their roots are disturbed and all of that. I think Brian's suggestion about transplant shock is probably... what's going on, and I think they probably, the new leaves that you'll see will be much better adapted to the new situation. So I'd keep an eye on them, but I think you're probably okay.
Well, I guess good thought. Thank you for your opinion.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate the call. And let's see, Carol in West Allis, I think, is next. Let's go there. Hi, Carol.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I also have a hydrangea question. I have a plant that's been in my yard for probably 4 years. And this year I've noticed that the leaves are drooping tremendously, especially when the sun shines on the plant, which is probably only about 3 or 4 hours out of the day. It seems to be getting worse, actually, instead of better. And I've noticed some spots on the stems of the hydrangea. It's an endless summer is the variety that I have planted. What's going on?
I would say, you know, from a disease standpoint, the things that, again, this is another situation where there are lots of things I can think of that could potentially cause that. The spots on the stems, they're localized spots, just kind of a discrete area, a spot on the stem. If it's near the base, there could be an infection, what we call a canker disease, and that can interfere with water movement in those stems, and that could lead to some wilting. With the rain we've had, West Allis, I'm assuming, has had the sorts of rain we've had the rest of it.
Plenty of rain, yeah.
Yeah. Then I would worry about root rot issues causing a problem that could lead to wilting as well. Verticillium wilt is another disease. It's a fungal disease where the fungus gets into the water conducting tissue and blocks it off. I've looked and looked and looked for that particular pathogen in hydrangeas over the years and never found it, but it wouldn't surprise me sometime that I would. So those are three possibilities. And again, trying to tease out which one of those might be from a disease standpoint, I'd need to see a sample in the clinic.
Mm-hmm. We also do tend to see some wilting when there's direct sun on those plants, if they're not grown in a real sunny situation. But what you're describing sounds to me more like a disease. And I concur, Brian. Send a sample in.
Yeah, and again, if you're interested in submitting a sample, just check out my website, and we have instructions there on how to do that. Or you can submit a sample through your county extension office.
Great. All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Carol. Appreciate your call. We have Mark in Dubuque, Iowa, with a question. Hi, Mark.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, quick question. In regards to tomato plants, I've got some pots that I've got tomato plants in. And for the last few years, I've been having just terrible problems with bottom rot, or some people call it blossom rot.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering, I was told that it's probably because there's like calcium deficiency in the soil. Any suggestions?
Okay. Are you using the same soil year after year?
No.
Okay.
I use new soil every year. I mix it up, compost, use some Miracle-Gro, stuff like that.
Okay. Usually it's not due to a calcium deficiency in the soil. It's due to a problem with calcium uptake. And calcium is taken up in the plants through their roots into the vascular system. And calcium is dissolved in the soil moisture and it gets taken up. If you have inconsistent moisture, so if your tomato plants tend to dry out and then you water them and then they dry out again and then you water them, so you don't have consistent moisture, then the calcium uptake is also inconsistent. And what happens is that it doesn't get into the fruits fast enough as they're developing. And you, because it's used in the cell wall development, you tend to have the back end or the blossom end of the tomato start to rot. So if you're having consistent moisture, and it sounds like, you know, you've got due to your Miracle-Gro and your compost and so on, you've probably got plenty of calcium in the soil. You may want to try a calcium spray, or better yet, just make sure that your watering is consistent. And if the plants tend to dry out, maybe they're not in a big enough pot, or you may want to put some mulch, some straw or something on top of the soil to keep that moisture consistent. You have anything else?
I've got a 5-gallon pot,
mm-hmm.
and this area of the country right now is, we've got lots of water.
Okay.
So we don't have to worry about that. So I was just kind of curious what I might do.
Are they the same kind of tomato, or are they an heirloom variety?
I've got heirlooms, and I've got, just some like little cherry tomatoes, and I've got some what they call big boys and whatever.
Mm-hmm. And you see this on all of them?
What's that?
You see it on all of them, or is it just some varieties?
No, actually, just one plant. And what I did when I saw the rot coming up, I picked off some of the fruit and got rid of them. And right now, I don't see any problem.
And sometimes we tend to see it at certain times of the year more than others. Like, we may tend to see it more on the earlier tomatoes rather than the later tomatoes. But a lot of the heirloom varieties are more susceptible to having that happen. Is that an heirloom variety?
Mm-hmm.
It is. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Do you have anything to add,
Ryan? No, other than, you know, if the watering isn't helping any, then maybe add
the
a little calcium to
spray.
The soil.
Yeah.
I would do it. I tend to recommend it when you plant, but at this point in the season, the sprays would be the way you have
way
to go.
Good luck, Mark. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Lisa Johnson, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County, and Brian Huddleston, Director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at the UW-Madison. Our guests, I'm Larry Mueller, here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Couple of great guests for you today on Garden Talk. Lisa Johnson and Brian Huddleston doing a wonderful job answering your gardening questions. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you so much for listening in today. Norman in Wausau called with a question, so I want to go there to Norm. Hi, thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I have an interesting problem. I have about a dozen or so fruit trees, and one of the trees, which is a Connell Red, and it's about 10 years old or so, so it's been bearing for some time. Last year, because of our frost up here in north central Wisconsin, it didn't have hardly any apples on it. And this year, all my other trees, they did well. They got apples, green apples on that are almost the size of a quarter, and some of the varieties are even larger already. But this tree didn't do a thing. It was just like it died over winter. And I checked around the roots. I couldn't find anything wrong or nothing had gnawed on it or anything. And about a week and a half ago, the buds started to swell up, and it actually blossomed, although I have to say the blossom buds weren't quite as good-looking as they would be on the other trees. And now they're shriveling up, and I don't know if it got pollinated because all my other trees were long done blossoming and had fruit on already. My question to you is, what on earth could be going on with that tree?
It sounds to me like some kind of stress from last year. Usually when we have things leafing out really late or not very well, are the leaves smaller than usual? Is it thinning at all? Or?
Well, the blossom clusters, which have leaves around them, those leaves are smaller and less vigorous looking than they should be by far.
Okay.
And I haven't seen any other leaves come out at all, in other words, on where there would be just buds and leaves. The only ones that have come out are the blossom buds and the leaves right around that blossom bud area.
Okay, yeah, that sounds like some major stress, but whether it's due to the drought from last year and some root death there, or some root death and then root rot this spring because of all the moisture, or some combination of the two.
Last year, I have a water meter that mm-hmm. I check, and I did water it a number of times when it showed that it was dry, and it seemed to do okay. It was one branch on it that the leaves weren't quite as good as the rest of them, and that had an apple or two on, and they didn't get nice and big like the Connell Reds normally would do. But that branch looks totally dead. It's just one small branch out of many. But other than that, the tree looks perfectly normal.
Could it be vert?
No, not apples. I don't know. No, I don't even think technically apples are susceptible to verticillium, and I would expect to see more major dieback if it were.
Yeah.
I tend to agree with you, Lisa, that I think it's some sort of stress from last year that's just set the tree back. And I guess my suggestion would be just to monitor the tree, kind of pamper it through the summer, and then see how it does next year.
Yeah. It when you don't see it leafing out, but you do see it blossoming, that's not a real good sign.
No.
Sometimes when trees do that kind of thing, they're kind of trying to preserve the species because they, not to ascribe thoughts to trees, but that they think they're going to die.
Yeah.
And so they tend to try and produce seed to propagate the species. I think Brian's advice is good.
I'm not real hopeful either. Sorry, but no. That particular tree may be on its way permanently out.
Sorry, Norm. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Pam in Ironwood, Michigan. Let's turn to you next. Hi, Pam.
Hi. I have about 8 holly bushes, and I'm out in the country in Ironwood Township. And they've 2 of them are about 4 years old. The other ones are only a couple of years old, but they were very healthy last year. Now there are lots of dead branches in the middle of them, particularly. They all have some life, but they're looking pretty sorry, so... Do you know what's happening?
Are these evergreen hollies or are they deciduous hollies?
They're evergreen.
They're evergreen.
Again, this is when you have dieback like this, I think about root issues of some kind or another.
Winter kill.
Winter kill. It could be infections by fungi in the individual branches. With the extensive dieback that you're seeing, I think it's something a little bit more generalized than that. Again, if you're interested, this would be something that if somebody called me on the phone, I would say get a sample in, because we need to really look at tissue to see what might be there or not there, quite frankly, to try to get a sense of what's going on.
Do you see at the bottom of the branches or the ones that are dying back in the middle, do you see any kind of spots or fungus or?
Not really. They're just looking very dead.
Okay.
Do deer eat holly?
That's a good
question. What don't deer eat, quite frankly, if they're desperate enough? That I don't know for certain, but
I doubt it. It's causing your problem, though.
No. Right, based on what you're describing.
Yeah.
No. Good luck. Thanks, Pam. Appreciate the call. Michelle in Prairie du Sac, let's give you a chance next. Hi, Michelle.
Hello. I have two questions, and one is, if you plant a garden, do you have to fertilize, or can you just kind of rely on the nutrients from the soil to, you know, make good tomatoes or whatever?
When you say garden, are you talking vegetable or are you talking...
Yeah, vegetable.
Okay, a vegetable garden. Well, you'll certainly get a much better harvest if you fertilize, and it doesn't have to be a traditional fertilizer. I mean, you could use composted manure, you could use grass clippings, but a lot of the vegetable plants, and tomatoes are one of them, are what we call heavy feeders, and they do a lot better if they are fertilized, but no, you don't have to if you've got halfway decent soil.
Mm-hmm. There we go.
My second question is on grass.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're cutting grass and it gets long, and you know how it kind of can reseed itself?
Yeah.
If you would just cut grass, are you kind of actually seeding your garden, or does it have to go through like a drying period or whatever?
Okay, well, Doug Soldat was actually talking about this, where when each Kentucky bluegrass plant that makes a seed head, after it seeds, it actually dies. But you have other grass plants in the lawn that will fill in for that. It's better if you're relying on your seed heads to do your reseeding that they do get to mature before they are recomposted or redistributed on the lawn, though. So I guess I wouldn't, you know, rely on that as your only means. But if you have a good stand of, you know, pretty dense turf, I wouldn't really worry about it.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you very much for that question. And an email from Joe in Portage County. Last fall, I successfully divided and transplanted 50 rhubarb plants. Every plant is thriving. I have no idea what I did right, but I'm not complaining. I know spring is a better time to move plants, but fall works better for my schedule. This fall, I'd like to replant several hundred more plants. Anything I can do to improve the chances of getting similar results this time?
Hmm.
We have about a minute or so. We can talk about
that. Yeah. I agree that spring is a better time for rhubarb. You must have one heck of a big yard. Rhubarb's big plant.
We're talking commercial scale here.
Yeah. You know, if you're going to do it in fall, do it in early fall. But, yeah, rhubarb is pretty tough. It's best transplanted in spring. But if you've had luck doing it in that time of year, I'd say go for it.
And Ruth Ann wondered about getting rid of slugs.
What we normally recommend is a little bit of beer in a container, and or you can do what my dad does, which is go out and pluck them off the plants at night with carrying a flashlight. So that's a little bit of a job, but
yeah,
a little bit of nice, rich, very yeasty beer. Oftentimes they'll crawl into that and they can drown in that.
Yeah, also other people will put out short pieces of board that the slugs can collect on overnight, and then you just have to smack that board against the ground in the morning. There are also, you can use Sluggo, which is iron phosphate pellets, but it's best applied early in the spring and after rains. And so we've had a lot of rain. So I think probably your method is best at the moment.
All right. So we have some photos and some, which I haven't had a look at myself, but there's some nice photos up on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Go to that Facebook page and we'll see what we've got here. Some nice garden photos. And we will keep them up so you will have a chance to see them. I can't look at them myself now because I can't work with my left hand for some reason on this mouse. But I'm happy to report that two guests today, Lisa Johnson. Lisa, is a UW Extension horticulture educator for Dane County. And our other guest, Brian Huddleston, who directs the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Our guest today to talk about all kinds of things in the garden. They're always happy to come, and we're always happy to have them with us. And I'm pretty sure you are as well. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are taking a look at what's going on in gardens around Wisconsin today. On this edition of Garden Talk, I'm Larry Mueller. A couple of great guests for you. Lisa Johnson, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. Been with us many times. Happy to have her back. Hi, Lisa. Thank you for coming.
Hi. Thanks, Larry.
And Brian Huddleston, Director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the UW-Madison Department of Plant Pathology. And Brian, always a pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
We have callers online. We have actually some open lines we can get you on pretty quickly with your gardening question at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. In the meantime, let's go to Sue in McFarland, who has a question. Hi, Sue.
Hi. I have tried several times at great expense over the last few years to grow a juga. I've tried several different spots. Last year, I put it in a planter box, and it was thriving, and I thought, good, next year I'll have a good crop, and I'll plant it, and it'll stay. It didn't come back again. I've tried it on a slope, I've tried it on flat ground, and I've tried it in a box, and every year it dies.
Wow. That, you know, most people have problems keeping their juga in the beds, and it tends to get into the lawns. I
can't keep it alive.
Yeah. Are you using the same variety every time or different varieties?
No, I'm sure it's different varieties because some of it's been bronzer looking. I really want the deep purple green and bumpy leaves.
Yeah, and you've got it in partial shade?
I've tried it everywhere.
Okay, full sun, partially.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because when I had it in the front of my house, it was underneath a tree and other bushes that were okay. Higher, and it still died. I had it on a slope on the side, which got, some sun, but it was doing okay.
Yeah.
You know, when we go into the fall, it looks like, okay, good, and then it just never comes back.
That is really strange.
Boy, I have no clue.
It says perennial on the label.
Yeah. And
usually it's weedy, quite frankly.
Yeah.
Like Lisa mentioned.
Now, I know that some years when we have some years we have winter kill issues with ajuga. I have seen that happen before, and it could be this year that it didn't like. Well, it was in a window box, and
right.
So window boxes are not always conducive to overwintering perennials. But
certainly the year before that.
Yeah, and you didn't have the ice the year before. Boy,
I don't know.
And you're able to grow other perennial plants really well,
yes.
I suppose?
Yes, I have some beautiful ferns going. And I thought they were done last year. I thought they just got fried, and they came up just beautiful again this year. I've got a poppy that comes back every year, even after my husband thought it was a thistle and yanked it one year.
Oh, dear.
Oh, your blood is boiling just thinking about it again, Sue.
There must have been a dozen blossoms on it. No. And I looked out the window, and I thought, where is it? And I went down there, and it was ugly.
Oh, dear.
Oh, man.
Yeah, sorry, with the ajuga, are you planting it in the spring usually?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I've gotten it from
multiple
the place
sources.
Stoughton. Yes,
yeah.
I've gotten it from the flower factory several times.
Yeah,
and I mean that's
place.
Perennials for this area.
Yeah. Would you be willing to consider a different plant? I mean, that's about the only recommendation. You've had such bad luck trying to grow that particular plant that at this, oftentimes with clients, I'll say, would you be willing to grow something else?
Yeah.
Okay, what could you suggest in something
a deep
color?
You're looking for something dark purple that's a ground cover?
Or dark green. I just want
dark
something
green.
Different. Yeah.
Off the top of my head, you know, I can think of lamium, but that's not dark green necessarily, but you can get silvery leaves. There are a number of different kinds of vinca, which is periwinkle. That's a good ground cover. If you want something to get out of control, there's golden archangel.
Pachysandra.
Pachysandra would be really good.
That'd be good.
My favorite plant, but that's just me.
It has flowers all over it, right?
Well, it does. Mm-hmm. It blooms later in the season. It's a semi-evergreen plant.
Okay.
It gets a little white spike of flowers.
The first one you said that started with an L, can you spell that one for me?
Lamium.
Thank you. I was like, which one did I say first?
Okay.
Lamium.
There you go. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling, Sue.
Yeah.
Appreciate your call. It's really weird.
I don't know.
What you got.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe try one more plant one more year. See, I would get to the point where I'd say, I'm going to grow this thing, or die trying.
And the nurseries love you, Larry.
Here comes Larry.
Oh, man. Kathleen in Indianapolis. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi there. Yes, I'm listening online. I do all day long, every day.
Oh, thank you.
And repeats whenever I've had to miss something, of course. But my question is about flowering dogwoods. I put a few, the native variety, in last fall, so they didn't have to cope, well, except at the nursery, with the awful drought and heat that we had all last year. They looked beautiful in the spring, and then all of a sudden, within the last couple weeks, the leaves have just been shriveling up and turning brown. One is fairly heavily shaded, so I'm thinking maybe it needs a little more sun, but the other one is getting pretty good mid and late day sun, and of course we've had lots of rain here too, so it's not that they haven't gotten enough water.
Hmm.
Okay. Although they are recently transplanted, so even with transplants, even if you think they're getting a lot of water just because of some pruning that happens when they're moved or damage to the roots, sometimes that can lead to water stress-like issues. We don't have a lot of flowering dogwood around here, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, this is Indianapolis, though.
Right.
So I
don't have a lot of experience with that
neither.
Particular plant.
Was it a bald and burlapped plant, or was it a containerized?
It was in a root bag.
Yeah.
Bald
and burlap.
Bald and burlap, then.
Okay, yeah. Well, depending on when it was dug up and bald and so on, there could be some root issues going on there.
Yeah, if it was dug early and sat in the nursery, you know, out of the ground, there could be a lot of heat damage to the roots, potentially. Did you plant the shrub, the trees, or were they planted for you?
No, I planted them myself.
Okay, did you remove the burlap and the wire basket underneath?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Very good.
Good for you.
Good for you, yes.
One thing I saw kind of doing a little research was that, and I found it was sort of an obscure mention, but that they prefer... Let me think here. The opposite of what I have, that they like morning sun and, morning sun, so that they, you know, I guess aren't too wet overnight, and then evening shade so that they're not too dry, or I guess don't get too much sunlight. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, if that's the case, then do I attempt to transplant them now or really wait and hope they make it to the fall and maybe try that then?
It sounds like they're under a lot of stress right now. I would wait until next spring. Actually, I wouldn't try fall planting okay. transplanting on that.
Good luck, Kathleen. Yeah.
The other thing I will mention is you have an absolutely wonderful diagnostic lab in Indiana at Purdue University. So take advantage of that particular lab if you're having plant disease issues. And they are a wonderful facility, and it's right in your home state. So feel free to contact them.
Just a little north of you. Just a little north. Thanks very much for calling, Kathleen, and thanks a lot for listening. Really appreciate it very much. We have from another listener from Indianapolis. No, here's somebody from Milwaukee, though. Kathy in Milwaukee has a question. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm calling today about Japanese red maples. They're blood good. That were planted about 8 years ago in my backyard. I'm on the east side of Milwaukee in the Lake Forest region, actually. And they've been doing really well. They're happy until this year. And they were watered plenty last year. But some of the branches on one of the two of them have not leafed out. The bare branches are on one side only. And there are branches above and below that do have leaves, but it's like there's a big hole on one side. And again, there's two of them, and it's just happening on one.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, so it's kind of a mystery, and I've been told by other people I've been talking to about this that they are experiencing the same issue with their maples, their red maples. So we're all kind of trying to figure out what's going on.
Yeah, my concern on a Japanese maple, there's a disease called verticillium wilt. They are quite susceptible, and you do get kind of a sectional dieback in the tree. The fungus enters in through the root system and blocks off water movement in the inside the branches, and that tends to be a fatal disease. I would suggest, again, with this particular problem, just to verify some of those branches that have just recently died back or have not leafed out, get a sample of those into my clinic so we can test to make sure that's what you're dealing with. That's not a good disease to have, unfortunately, if that's what you're dealing with.
Oh, gosh. Okay. And did I'm catching bits of your show today.
Sure.
Did I hear instructions as to how to get the sample in and to take the sample?
Yeah. If you go to my clinic website, which is pddc.wisc.edu.
We have it on,
all right.
Have it on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. That might be the simplest way.
And definitely just look in sample submission. There's actually, look under special samples, and it'll have a section on sampling for verticillium wilt, Dutch elm disease, and oak wilt.
There you go. Good
and
luck.
There's also a contact page on there as well. So if you have questions, you just click on that, and then you can send me an email.
All right.
And on the less fatal side of things, it could just be, we did have a rather difficult winter for a lot of woody plants, so it could just be that a couple of the branches died back for whatever idiopathic reasons. We do tend to see, like Brian said, a lot of verticillium wilt, but if you're hearing from other people that are experiencing this, that could be it. I still would recommend what Brian says about sending in a sample, though, just to be sure.
If you have that particular disease, you've got to be very, very careful what you replant, and that's one of the reasons why I really do encourage testing for that.
Right.
Thanks again for calling. I appreciate it. I want to go to our Facebook page because there's several photos, several pretty cool photos, but Andrea sent us one.
Heartbreaking photo.
Heartbreaking photo. Their community garden's pretty much wiped out. And this is a question I think a lot of people might be having. What should we be aware of if we choose to replant in land that has been flooded? And just in general, replanting. That's a good question this time of the this particular season.
Yeah, you really need to be aware of where some of that water may have come from, and there may be things that were carried in the water that you really don't want in an area where you're growing vegetables. I think my recommendation, Lisa, you probably know more about this than I do, quite frankly, would be to get a soil test done, and I would probably check for heavy metals and that sort of thing just to be safe.
And if you have, it looks like a fairly rural area, if there are dairy operations or anything like that where you could have had runoff that had fecal contamination in it, that's that's an issue. We have a publication. Is it at the Learning Store, Brian, or your site?
No, there's a. It's on my website. We have a one-page fact sheet, one of our University of Wisconsin garden facts, called "Safely Using Vegetables" or something about safely using produce from flooded gardens or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it's about what happens if you've got a garden, you've got some vegetables growing. They're not totally killed or wiped out, but you've got vegetables around. Can you use them? Can you not use them? That sort of thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I see that one of the listeners had written back about bioremediation. That is something to look into as well. And I know there are some companies that specialize in that kind of thing. I don't know whether that's in your budget, but you might also just consider if this is a continuing issue that you move the garden to some place where it doesn't flood quite so often.
Yeah. Marilyn sent us a photo of a weed. I'm trying to think what it is.
It almost looked like a plantain.
A little bit.
Not English plantain, but a different type of plantain, or Brian thought it might
was my first thought on that, or one of my thoughts on it. What I would suggest with this, because it's always difficult to tell from photos, unless you're a real weed expert, would be to first send it to your county extension office and request that they forward it on to one of our weed specialists. Mark Rentz is one of the folks who is very good from photos of identifying weed pictures.
And if you want to see some pretty azaleas,
so lovely.
Go to the gorgeous Facebook page. Marilyn sent us some picture, a photo of her azaleas, and then another of her iris plant.
It's lovely, too.
Pretty.
Lovely as well, up on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Lavetta in Williams Bay is next. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. I have a question. Okay, I have some grapevines, and I believe they're Concords, and last year I got a fabulous crop and made some amazing jam. But this year, I just noticed yesterday that they're starting to mold. The grapes themselves are starting to mold.
Yeah, there's several things that could be a possibility. My first thought is downy mildew. That's a common fungal. Well, it's not truly a fungus, but we'll call it that. That's a problem that we see on grapes, and oftentimes the fruits will get this kind of whitish, grayish, whitish mold on the surface. If you're just seeing a very almost snow white sort of coating on the fruits without any real collapse underneath, it could be powdery mildew. And again, that would be something, if you really need to know exactly what it is, would be to get a fruit sample into my clinic so we can check. There are some other fungi that can attack fruits and cause some rot problems, but those are probably the most common too. Oftentimes, if you want to prevent, particularly downy mildew, which tends to be the more problematic of the two diseases. Again, I think I mentioned earlier in the hour, copper-containing sprays can help with that. Bordeaux mix is a very traditional combination of copper sulfate and lime that's been used for grape production for a long, long time. And that would be something that, as a home gardener, you could find at a garden center.
Mm-hmm.
But you need to get that on before you see any symptoms. It's something you start early in the season.
Thanks for calling again. And Joya in Fitchburg will give you a chance. Hi, Joya.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I have two questions. Is the wisteria is suitable for our zone? Because some of the nurseries are selling it. I've seen it in California and in the warmer climate like southern states. But, you know, I don't know whether it is appropriate to, will they grow in our zone?
Yes, except that you have to be careful of the variety. We don't usually recommend the Chinese types that have the larger flower panicles. Those are not as hardy in our area, and they also they tend to get dieback and so on. I have a wisteria in my backyard. I think it is Blue Moon. It's one of our native wisterias. And you can find them at various nurseries in the area. I've had really good luck with mine.
Well, do they need a sunny spot?
Yes, they do. Okay, and they need a good solid structure for having them grow on. It can't just be a wimpy, you know, cedar trellis. They need some good support.
Okay. Also, when is the best time to trim back the peonies? Because I'm getting, those spots, fungal spots on the leaves, on the peonies. They're done blooming.
Mm-hmm.
So is it a good time to trim them back, or should I wait until fall?
I would wait till fall, quite frankly, because even if you've got some spots in the leaves, those leaves are still producing nutrients for the plant, and those are going to be stored in the crowns and root systems. So I would leave that foliage as long as you possibly can.
Or if you've only got a couple of leaves that have a couple of spots, you can remove those particular leaves, but don't cut the whole plant down.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. And can you tell me how do I prevent also the spreading of the Monarda? It's taking over the whole garden.
No. It does that.
Yeah.
Eternal vigilance, I guess, is what I do. And just I attack it from the edges and, you know, work my way back towards the center just to keep it in its own area. If it's in a wetter area, it does really tend to spread. It is one of those more, shall we say, enthusiastic or exuberant perennials. I wouldn't really call it a thug, but it can be.
There we go. Thanks, Joanne, for calling. Appreciate it. Connor and Blair, do you have a quick question?
Yes. A few years ago, we had gotten a Norwegian variegated maple tree, and it had a disease, but it came back. But now it's starting to lose its variegation, and so now all the leaves have just kind of gone green, and now I'm just kind of curious, is there something that can be done? Will it kind of come back to its normal variegation next year?
Probably not. The Norway maple that you're speaking of is probably Harlequin, and Harlequin is not a stable variegation. It tends to revert back to the green wild type. So the only way to control that, to keep it from taking over the whole tree, is to remove the branches that have all green leaves on them so that only the variegated ones are remaining. But if all that's left is green, then it's reverted. So it probably won't return to being a variegated plant.
Sorry, Connor.
It's unfortunately pretty common with Harlequin maple.
And Harriet in Muscadet has no choice. She has to remove a perennial bed, which includes peonies, right now. Would it be better to put the perennials in pots, plant them in the fall, or just put them in the ground somewhere else now?
Well, I'd minimize the amount of times you have to move them. So instead of putting them in the ground somewhere else, unless that's their final destination, I guess I would put them in pots.
With that, we are out of time.
Oh, my gosh. That went fast.
It flies, doesn't it? Oh, man. Thank you so much. You two will come back and be with us again, I hope.
Yes, indeed.
Oh yes.
Appreciate it very much. Lisa Johnson, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County, and Brian Huddleston directs the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the UW-Madison Department of Plant Pathology. They will be back. We will have them again. Peter Green of Infostar.com joins us on Monday to talk about your personal computer problems. Have a great weekend. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.